format of how this is going to work is we're going to talk a little bit about our research process this year and how that led to our new charity recommendations for 2012, which we released today. Then we'll take some questions and discuss those. Then we'll also talk about our plans for future research into some new areas that we haven't covered before and take some questions about those. And then we're happy to just have kind of general open Q&A about anything you want to know about GiveWell. And then, you know, maybe after about an hour, we'll break up and you know, the GiveWell staff will stick around and, you know, we're happy to just have conversation and answer any questions you have. But before we get started, I just wanted to quickly go around and have people who are affiliated with GiveWell introduce themselves. So first we'll go around and just hit the staff members, and then there's also some GiveWell board members that are here, just so folks know who the GiveWell folks are. So I'm Ellie Hassenfeld. I'm one of GiveWell's co-founders.
I'm Holden Karnowski. I'm the other co-founder.
I thought we'd do a staff.
Oh, yeah. I'm Bethany Trinkman. I'm a research analyst.
I'm Elijah Kepler.
I'm also a research analyst.
I'm Alexander Berger. I'm also a research analyst.
And we have a couple research analysts who don't live in New York, so they're not here. There's two more research analysts, Natalie and Jonah, who both work for GiveWell.
And I'm Tom Rutledge. I'm on the board.
Tim Ogden, I'm on the board.
Gary Tina, I'm on the board.
Great, thanks. Okay, so I'm going to start in and just talk a little bit about the research we did in 2012 and how that led to the recommendations we have today, and then we can have some discussion about those before turning it over to Holden to talk about our future research. So today we released our updated recommendations, and we have three top charity recommendations: the Against Malaria Foundation, which fights malaria in Africa; the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, which works on deworming children largely in Africa, and both of these were top organizations in 2011 as well. And then we have a new top-rated organization called GiveDirectly, who focuses on directly transferring 90 cents on every dollar that it receives to extremely poor individuals in the developing world. So, you know, two of the three organizations that we're recommending are ones that we recommended last year. And so I guess I just want to give some more insight into what we worked on in 2012 and how we arrived at, you know, the recommendations we have now. So we largely worked on a few different areas of research. One area was continuing to analyze and follow the organizations that we had recommended in the past. And so that meant continuing to understand what the Against Malaria Foundation had done, what impacts their past bed net distributions had, how well they went, what problems they found, and continue to understand how they would use additional money. We asked the same types of questions of SCI, the organization that works on deworming, and we also continued to do that for Village Reach, which was an organization we had recommended most strongly in 2010 and earlier. So in addition to following the organizations themselves that we recommended, we also focused on the interventions that the organizations run to understand any new evidence that was coming out that might have an impact on our rankings. And so we worked on a variety of questions. One of the ones that, you know, to us was really important was this question of whether mosquitoes are evolving in ways that lead bed nets to be less effective than they've been in the past. So, you know, people sleep under these bed nets, and it protects against the mosquitoes that transmit malaria. But if the mosquitoes are evolving either biologically, evolving resistance to the nets, or changing their behavior to bite people at times when they might be awake and not under the nets, well, that would call into question the past evidence that nets are effective. So we did a lot of work on that question. There have been a variety of questions like that we've tried to answer for the organizations that we recommend. And those are important to us because if we learn something new about the research for the program, that would change our view of how effective the charities are. In both the case of malaria and the deworming organization, the answers were, you know, sufficiently positive that we stayed recommending them as we did before. You know, another big area that we worked on this year was continuing to follow organizations that hadn't received our top rankings at the end of 2011, but nonetheless seemed promising. GiveDirectly, which is now one of our top charities, was an example of an organization like this, where we thought they had a reason that they might be good, and so we continued to investigate them. they ended up with a top rating. There were other organizations that we looked at too that didn't end up getting those high ratings. So that, you know, organizations like Doctors Without Borders, Deworm the World, PATH, and a host of others, all of which have pages now on our website, organizations we looked into as ones that could potentially end up in our top rankings. But probably the area on which we spent the most time in trying to find new top-rated organizations was identifying causes and programs that seemed particularly proven and cost-effective, and then trying to find organizations that could effectively take in money and use that money to implement more of that program. So one example of that where we spent the most of our effort was on immunizations. Immunizations are incredibly cheap. We know that they save lives. And so we went looking for organizations that could use money to immunize more children. And as we looked, what we found was that, you know, we talked to basically all the organizations that were working on immunizations, and by and large, it seemed to us that immunizations are so well accepted to be proven and cost-effective that the obvious gaps to use money to do more of them were no longer there. And instead of the challenge being needing to raise enough money so that the organizations could distribute sufficient number of vaccines, the type of needs were very different. They related to coordination between different partners or coming up with innovative ways of reaching people who lived in particularly hard to reach areas. There were a couple times over the course of the year as we were talking to these organizations like the UNICEF, the WHO, where we thought there was going to be a gap where an organization said, you know, in this case it was, I think, the Measles Initiative that said, you know, we have a large gap. We're not going to be able to run these campaigns to immunize children for measles. And as we were investigating the gap, other donors came in and they filled the gap. And so this all painted a broad picture of the fact that in, you know, cases where the evidence is so strong, it may be hard to find gaps that individual donors can fill, because they're so well accepted as good options that the larger donors have already come in and essentially provided enough funding for the programs to work as well as they can with funding. And this general theme was borne out as well in another cause we looked into, the cause of iodizing salt, which has a pretty good track record of long-term impacts on development. So, you know, going through that whole process, we didn't find, you know, much in this investigating causes approach that we took. We found one new organization in our going back to organizations that had been promising at the end of last year, and then we continued to feel real good about our top two charities from the previous year, SCI and AMF. And then a lot of what we spent our time on over the last couple of weeks is really delving into the details of the strengths and weaknesses of each of these organizations to figure out how we would rank each of them. And, you know, we've published a lot about this, so I'm not going to go into all the details right now, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have about it. You know, basically, just to frame the discussion, when we look at these different donation opportunities, we're thinking about two types of issues. There's issues of how effective the intervention is, meaning, you know, what types of impacts do you expect to get from distributing bed nets? How much does it cost to distribute bed nets? And how confident are you that those impacts really exist? And then on the flip side, that's different than the intervention. There's also questions about the organization itself, which is, you know, how likely is this organization to implement this program well? And that means answering questions like, what is this organization's track record? How self-critical are they, such that if there are problems, they'll identify them and fix them? How easily are we able to understand what's happening with the organization, such that we feel confident that we know the impact of additional dollars? And then finally, you know, aside from just the direct benefits of the program that they're implementing, are there ways in which donating to this organization could have long-term upside in terms of the greater benefits that it could offer? And so just to give one example of a type of upside, you know, if an organization is particularly good at researching its programs, that may not only help it do better, but it may also help other organizations learn from it, and that itself has a broader impact. And so those are the factors that, you know, we relied on in trying to figure out how to rank these organizations. And what we settled on was a pretty strong number one recommendation for the Against Malaria Foundation, and then two other organizations that we give our top rating to, Give Directly, which we gave our number two ranking, and then SCI, which we gave our number three ranking. So with that, I just wanted to open the floor to questions and discuss any of the above, our process, causes we looked into, and our top charities and how we rank them. Yeah, so I'm just going to repeat the question for the sake of the recording. So the question is, you know, it seems like the question of how effective the people are who are running the organization, it takes into account the, in some ways, the effectiveness of the intervention, since, you know, better people are likely to pick better people. People who have the attitude of assessment and evaluation are likely to pick causes that are particularly promising. And so, you know, it's something that, you know, I think that, you know, to some extent there's overlap, and I think that to some extent we see some of the leaders of, you know, the organizations that we recommend proactively choosing the causes that they do because of the evidence that the programs are effective. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of people, I'm sure, who pick areas to work on that we wouldn't deem very effective, but they're extremely competent at running the organization, and they're self-critical and evaluating the impact of the organization to the extent that is possible within the context of the program that they run. And, you know, so to us, it still seems like these different approaches to understanding the impact that a program has need to be evaluated separately, and they're both incredibly important because one doesn't necessarily overlap with the other. So the question is, you know, what are the explanations that people give for picking areas that are that have less strong empirical evidence?
People are otherwise very good.
Yeah, I mean, there's two answers to that question. One is, you know, we tend to pick the areas to look at that we think are most effective. And so we've definitely spent a lot more time talking with people who focus on programs that have strong track records, immunizations, or broadly global health and nutrition programs. You know, than people who haven't, so I don't have as much insight into the, you know, those people that we haven't spoken with as much. You know, nonetheless, I think one particular way in which GiveWell is different than, you know, than average, let's say, is, you know, we tend to be more skeptical of the conclusions of academic evidence on their face than other people may be. And so I think there's a lot of programs that, you know, some would say are very effective, and we, you know, we look at the research and we say, you know, this program doesn't seem sufficiently effective to us. The, you know, there's too many methodological problems that have led to the, you know, the ultimate conclusion that we don't rely on the evidence.
Something I would add is, you know, when you ask why do people choose the causes they choose to work on, you know, I think that the most common thing we see is that it's not based on a calculation of how to have the most impact. And, you know, this idea of kind of saying, well, what problem should I work on? And answering it with, well, whichever one has the most impact, let me figure that out, I think is a very unusual attitude. Is something that we kind of see as maybe a, you know, one of the things that distinguishes GiveWell from the way a lot of others think. So, you know, that said, I mean, we're not looking, when we look for people who are great at what they do, we're not necessarily looking for people who'd be great at running GiveWell. It's different criteria, it's different skills, and so I think that's not really, we're not talking to these people and saying, did they do our job well of looking at all the different causes and figuring out which one has the highest impact? We're instead, you know, it's different. It's, did they do their job well? Are they executing, you know, so this guy picked bed nets. You know, we could tell the story of how the guy running AMF picked bed nets, and I think it's some combination of impact and happenstance. But what's really important is he getting the bed nets delivered? Is he showing results? And is he being transparent about it so that we can track what's going on? So that when we talk about the quality of the organization, our confidence in an organization, this is something that I don't think we formalized as well as we could, and we're going to be writing more about it, but it generally comes down to, like, do we have a good sense of how things are going? Have we seen the documentation we need to see to understand what dollars do and what the results are, and then are the results, you know, good? Are they in line with what we would hope for? And that's a very different question from whether this person is good at reviewing academic literature.
My question is going to seem like it's a content question related to a particular organization, but it's really more geared at your process. And so forgive me if it sounds like it's advocacy or something, but I'm talking about the Fistula Foundation, and I'm focusing specifically on the statement on your website that you couldn't be convinced of incrementality, or that's not your word, but I think we all understand, in other words, that there are incremental surgeries being done as a result of the dollars, and that you weren't convinced by the evidence. And so I have no idea whether there are or there aren't. I'm kind of agnostic on that question, although in principle, the organization seems like it. If it were creating incremental surgeries, it would be a fantastic organization to support, among many, many others. But my question is how you reach the conclusion, or what would constitute evidence to you that there were incremental surgeries being performed?
So we have, this has been a huge... Oh, yeah, sorry. So the question is, you know, when you look at, this is just an example that was given, the Fistula Foundation, which does, you know, corrective surgeries, we said we couldn't get convinced of the incrementality of the situation. In other words, we were not convinced that extra dollars would lead to extra surgeries, and how do we make that determination? So this is something that we've really struggled with over the years, and I would say when we started off, we had the intuition that this was really important, but we just didn't know how to go about it. And, you know, over the years, we've developed a methodology that I think is pretty good for answering this question, which is to basically, you know, you start with the softer questions. You start with saying, well, what would you do differently if you had more dollars? And a lot of times there, you might get an answer that surprises you, because I think it's actually very common that a charity sees a gap. They, you know, talk about the gap. They say, we could do all these surgeries if we only had this money. They raise that money pretty quickly, and then they're doing other things because there's limits to things besides money. And so, you know, where we get really formal with the analysis, we call it room for more funding analysis, is we'll basically ask for a set of scenarios, and we'll say, how much revenue do you expect over the next year, and what would be your activities under that revenue, and then what happens if the revenue is 10% greater than expected or 10% less than expected? What activities are first to get cut? What activities are the ones that are going to be added on? And the advantage of this kind of analysis, you know, the traditional way of doing this, I think, is flawed, because you would say, how are you going to spend my money? And they'll say, we'll spend your money on surgeries. Then they take your money and they say, this was spent on surgeries. And then they take some other money that didn't have any strings attached and they spend it on something else. And so that you didn't really have the effect you wanted to have. But if you're doing it our way, we're not asking about our money. We're asking the total budget. What happens if your total budget is 10% bigger, 10% smaller? And then they've got a statement on the record that we can go back and check. We can say, okay, this is what actually happened. Did your activities come out in line with what you said they would be in this scenario? So that's our basic approach. Sometimes it ends up more complicated than that. Sometimes it ends up simpler. I mean, GiveDirectly, they're like, well, with up to $5 million, 90% of it would be cash transfers using the current system. And with the next $5 million, we would have to hire someone else, but then it'd be the same thing. And beyond that, we'd have to talk. And so, but that's something we can go back and look at. We can say, okay, you guys got $7 million. You know, did a certain amount of it go to cash transfers? And if not, why not?
The thing that, you know, we've experienced very consistently, because we don't have the time to go to every single organization where we're not convinced about the incrementality of donations and follow up and find out what happened. But something we've seen with the organizations that we followed most closely, which is the organizations to which we've directed funds, is the result of how money ends up getting spent is always significantly more nuanced than we would have thought going in based on what they initially told us. And we've gotten better at knowing what questions to ask so that we can have the right prediction about how we expect money to get spent. But it, you know, it adds to our general, you know, general level of skepticism at just accepting an organization's first claim about how it intends to spend additional dollars, because we so rarely see that play out in a very simple way.
Can you give a concrete example?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example is Village Root. So this is this organization that we recommended. You know, it was our top-rated organization in 2009 and 2010, and then at the end of 2011, we made it no longer our top recommendation because we felt it had received sufficient funds. And it wasn't going to be the best use of marginal donations. When we first recommended them in 2009, you know, what they said is, you know, we implemented this pilot project in Mozambique between 2002 and 2007. With additional dollars, we're going to scale up to more provinces. You know, GiveWell in 2009 was a, you know, significantly younger and, you know, less mature organization. And we said, well, that sounds great, you know, scaling up. And we definitely asked, you know, some critical questions. But you can go and read some back and forth we had with, you know, some donors at the time. And we hadn't pushed Village Reach very hard on how this scale-up was going to work. And, you know, what happened over the course of the next 2 years was, you know, challenges that the organization had getting government sign-off to allow them to implement this program in certain provinces. When they had the money to implement the program, sometimes other funders who were also necessary to support parts of the program because they were essentially funding the ministries of health in those countries, they didn't come through with funds. And so even though Village Reach had the funding to run their program, other funders didn't come through, and Village Reach's access to funds was not the bottleneck to more happening. And there's been other, like, smaller detail. I mean, Village Reach runs a program that helps with health systems logistics, meaning they don't buy the vaccines, but they help vaccines reach the places that need them. In late 2010, there was a recall, essentially, on one of the vaccines that Village Reach was distributing. And so the vaccine was no longer there. No matter how good your logistics are, if the vaccine is not in the country because there's been a problem, you're not going to be able to run your program. And so those are just three examples that we learned about because we were following Village Reach really closely. But they're the types of things that it now seems likely to me would occur in lots of cases where that story seems compelling, but you haven't really dug into all the facts.
And things also do change, which complicates things. I mean, certainly, you know, Schistosomiasis Control Initiative is a good example where, like, they've explicitly said to us, I mean, there's lots of things we could do, and we're not going to tie ourselves down to one set of activities. And we think that's perfectly fine, and flexibility is good. And it does make, you know, but it does make it complicated. But we at least, you know, I think that we have generally done a good job sniffing out where it's really going to be, like, more people served with more dollars versus where it's really going to be something qualitatively different, and you know, often it's something qualitatively different.
Sure.
I think from a donor's perspective, one of the most motivating things about GiveWell is the dollar per life saved figure that you guys have for your top charities. And, having read a little bit that you've written on the website about how that number is kind of, you know, obviously can't be concrete because you don't know if all the data you're getting is, you know, fully accurate. If you did have to, you know, put a sort of margin for error, like a plus or minus, you know, error percentage on the data that you have for life saved for the top charity, what do you think it would be?
So we've done that. I mean, our cost effectiveness analysis, the question is, so we publish these numbers that are like cost per life saved, and the question is if we had to put confidence intervals on them, like say, you know, what the range is that we think they could reasonably be, what would our ranges be? And we've tried to communicate this, although it is like buried in the website, but we publish spreadsheets. So, you know, I'll go through them one at a time. I mean, Against Malaria Foundation, current estimate is like $2,300 per life saved. And in the spreadsheet, I mean, we have a bunch of different assumptions you could have about nets lasting longer or less long. And, you know, the numbers don't change all that dramatically. They might go to like $1,500, $5,000 per life saved, which is a factor of a few, but it's nothing, you know, earth shattering. That's taking account of like questions like how long do nets last? There's things that we just can't quantify. So like, maybe nobody uses the nets, and all the data that says people use the nets is just, like, fabricated. Maybe all the mosquitoes are resistant by now. I mean, maybe nets have no effect. I'm sorry, but it may be true. And conversely, you know, maybe this cost per life saved is just a wild understatement of cost effectiveness, because there's a lot of benefits to reducing the burden of malaria besides saving lives. And, you know, there could be all kinds of things going on where people learn to use the nets from others and, you know, all kinds of leverage you could imagine, right? But the number is, like, pretty bounded in terms of, like, what a reasonable estimate is using the best available data. If you go to deworming, you get a very different story. So deworming is basically you're treating children or sometimes adults for parasitic infections. And we know that the pills work. We know the pills kill the parasitic infections. We don't have a good handle on what those infections mean for quality of life. And there's basically like a study or a couple studies that indicate that children who are dewormed earn substantially more money 10 years later in life, which is would be really impressive if true. Now you've got these questions. Okay, how credible is this study? How likely is it that this study would be replicated if we did the study again? That's something we've tried to look at kind of the numbers from the biomedical literature to say how often does a study get replicated? But it's really hard to make comparisons because a medical, you know, a clinical trial is very different from this thing where they kind of went to Kenya and tried to keep track of people for 10 years. And so that's a huge question. There's other questions like how do you value this benefit of people earning more money? What does that mean to you? How do you compare that to lives saved? There's all kinds of range around that, right? You get into questions of discount rates, which can be a very frustrating topic because you're going to give someone benefits 10 years in the future, or you can give someone else benefits now, and how do you compare those? And, you know, a little change in your discount rate can really blow up the comparison. So when we try to bound, I mean, we try to do like a cost per equivalent life saved for deworming, and our range using the best assumptions we could was like $50 to like $20,000. And that really, I mean, even that kind of understates the uncertainty in my opinion. So that is what it is. That's deworming. And that's bed nets too, because bed nets could have a lot of those same developmental effects and it's very hard to value them. And then cash transfers. I mean, you know, I think with cash transfers, we basically said, look, you give $1,000 and $900 of it will get to someone very poor. We've done some other numbers. We're going to do a blog post on this. We can do the kind of the cost per person per year for a tin roof. But, you know, it's not we're not able to connect that to any kind of equivalent to life save. So that's the answer, is that it's very, very wide uncertainty, but we've done the best we can.
So for AMF, I think last year the number for life save was $1,600. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was initially higher, but it got down to around 1,600, 1,700 as we made various corrections.
Okay, and now it's
2,300. We made a big correction, and we wrote a post about this where basically we did a very deep dive on all the numbers that went into it, and infant mortality has declined a lot since the mid-90s when the original studies were done, and so that's another huge question, right? I mean, you used to have a certain level of infant mortality, and bed nets reduced infant mortality about 20%. Now you have a lower level of infant mortality. Do you want to assume bed nets still reduce at 20%? If you do, you get our $2,300 number. You could assume that bed nets are now not saving any lives because all the lives they would have saved are the lives that have been saved by other means, by improved nutrition. Or you could say that bed nets are saving more lives because people who wouldn't have survived before can survive now if only you avert the malaria. So that's, you know, that's another example. And, you know, we're not a marketing outfit, so we're going to be honest about all this stuff. We really don't know. We've done our best, and I think what the numbers are useful for is, A, it does give you a general sense that these things are pretty good deals. I think, and that can be done in a variety of ways. It doesn't have to be a cost per life saved, but you can see the cost per year. You can talk about what that means, what the effects are. You can see this is a good deal. It's 50 cents to deworm a child, and maybe that means that it helps them 10 years later. Like, wow, that, you know, that doesn't need to be turned into some very complicated thing to show you it's good. So that's one purpose of the numbers, is just the very vague sense that they're a good deal. Another good thing about the numbers, you know, you can occasionally detect just, like, indisputable differences. For example, flying a child over to the U.S. to have heart surgery and flying them back is not going to be as cost effective as bed nets, but maybe we knew that before. And then the final, I mean, the biggest reason that I would give for continuing to work really hard on these numbers that I honestly don't have a lot of confidence in, is that they're really good tools for us to think hard and ask all the questions we need to ask. So we've learned all kinds of stuff by going to these numbers and being like, what if this number were off? What if that number were off? Is this a good assumption? Is that, and we learn a lot, and that doesn't necessarily translate into numbers that, that we can promise you are right, but you know, it's, I think it's a good tool, but it's important to know the limitations.
Yeah.
If I could follow up on that question where it was mentioned that, you know, the charities before this year at least had that, I call it kind of the Peter Singer flavor, which is saving lives, your objective is to get bang for your buck, you can actually, you know, save lives. And then this year, when I had the chance to listen to most of the conference call on November 20th, but when I read ahead of that call and then listened to the rationale for the Give Directly, it was a little bit of a head scratcher, especially when I tried to give the elevator speech to my wife. You know, she didn't listen to the call, but she's going, wait a minute, I thought you were saving lives, and now this is transfer payments? Transfer payments? I know, obviously, they're very poor people and all that, but. You know, where you can't quantify, you know, I gave the example that was on the call about, you know, thatched roof turning into a tin roof or metal roof. And it strikes me that it's so qualitatively different than what you've done in the past that, you know, I found you guys by the Peter Singer book, The Life You Can Save, and sort of had that as a motivation. And it left me thinking, wow, if you have a group of very smart, motivated analysts scouring the world for effective organizations that are trying to save lives, and the conclusion is, boy, beyond 2.5 or so, there are just not many, so we really need to get in the transfer payment business. You know, am I missing something? Is that, it's, in some ways it's a very positive finding, because maybe the world's doing a better job helping the, you know, helping save lives than many of us thought. But on the other hand, it seems like it's almost a qualitatively different type of organization now you've decided to support. It's almost like a, you know, to use an investment company analogy, if you're an investment company investing in small cap companies with established track records and management teams and things that you could quantify, and then you say, no, but now we're also going to invest in a highly speculative internet startup that might do great, but there's only a 1,000 chance it will. It's way more speculative. It just seems like, almost from a branding perspective of what the world's been about, it's a big, big departure. So I know you've talked a little bit about that, and I understand that it sounds like you've said that it's internally very, very controversial. So I think maybe shedding some light more on the kind of internal controversy would be pretty interesting to us, especially with the branding or, you know, the Life You Can Save aspect.
Sure. Well, there was a lot in that question. Let me try and summarize it quickly. The kind of, you know, I guess the way I'd put the question, let me know if how I do here, is that kind of we may have started out or been perceived or branded ourselves as kind of answering the question Peter Singer asks, how much does it cost to save a life? Now we're talking about cash transfers, which is just very qualitatively different. It seems like you can't really compare it, and it's not the kind of work we've done before. And so, you know, A, how do we think about that comparison? B, why are we doing this? And how do we think about the effect on our brand? Is that kind of...
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So, I mean, a couple answers. So first, I mean, one of the components of that question that I didn't really capture in what I just said, but it's, you know, why are there so few opportunities to save lives in these highly quantified, proven ways? I think it's a combination. I think it's a combination that there are a limited number of interventions that are really proven to save lives, and then the ones that are often do bring in enough money that they cover them. So, you know, there's not... I mean, water, for example, I think has not been studied as much as it could have been. Clean water. Does clean water save lives? I think that's not been studied as much as it could have been. On the other hand, immunization is very well proven and they're funded. So to get this kind of intersection point, this kind of middle of the Venn diagram, well, it's proven, it works, you know, it saves lives really cheaply and we know it, but it's not funded, is pretty rare, and I think that's partly a good reflection on the world, partly bad, right? It's limited research, but it's also the funding comes in when the research is there. So, you know, I think that's part of the answer. In terms of what we're doing and why we're doing it, I mean, I think that our mission has always been to find outstanding giving opportunities, and we don't want to be constrained by kind of saying, well, we only do this kind, we only do that kind, and we're gradually broadening out. And I think everyone at GiveWell is on board with that basic idea, that we want to be slowly branching and broadening and giving people more options, but also just opening ourselves up. Because when I look at what GiveWell is and what its potential is, it's not a highly retail mass market kind of operation. We have very sophisticated audience. The people who follow us tend to be very intellectual, analytical, critical, and I think that we are going to do more good kind of bringing them along for the ride as we learn about how to do philanthropy and how to do it really well, even if that's not what we originally had in mind. I think that's the right direction for GiveWell, rather than kind of trying to keep things simple, keep them as they originally were, and give people what they originally wanted. So I think everyone at GiveWell is on board with that. Basic direction. I think it's the right thing to do. I think we'll find better giving opportunities, and I think that we'll help people who don't have time to study this stuff understand why the world of charity doesn't work maybe exactly the way they thought it did when GiveWell started up. On the question of Give Directly versus the health charities, so we don't actually see, I mean, I certainly don't see this as much of a departure as maybe it's being portrayed. I could see us doing other things that would be much more of a departure. But I think, this is still, to me, in the paradigm of I spend a certain amount of dollars, I help a certain number of people. They're very, very poor people. I know how many I helped. It gets very hard to quantify exactly what I did for them. That's true with all the interventions, including the health interventions. So I feel pretty good about it. One thing we've noticed is people have very different intuitions about health versus wealth and which one is like more important. And so some people will say, well, health is clearly so much more core and so much more morally basic. And why would I give someone money who's kind of not in danger with their health or not in mortal danger? And other people would say, well, I don't really care about saving lives. Like, people who are dead don't feel pain. And, I want people to have better lives. This is a philosophical dilemma that, I don't know, we all have different opinions on. We're not trying to resolve it and give the answer. But certainly, one of the inputs into this ranking and into the allocation is we all asked ourselves, where am I going to give my own personal money this year? Because all of us donate to charity. That's what I think keeps GiveWell honest. And I think that's a better rule than kind of which charity fits these five criteria that were kind of dreamed up back when we didn't know anything about charity. I think the better rule is where would I give? So that's how we try to be as analytical as we can about it. We give the reasons why we give where we give. We've broken up these charities into, here are their strengths, here are their weaknesses. But that's the underlying question that's driving it all.
So I wanted to add a couple of things just about the organization itself and the program of distributing cash and why we find that approach so attractive, relative to these other organizations, even though it definitely struck me, and I think it strikes many people as very counterintuitive. Like, is it really the case that giving $1,000 to a poor family could be among the best possible uses of charitable dollars? One major factor is this question we talked about before, which is, what do we believe about our cost effectiveness estimates? I think if you really believed with confidence that $1,000 is saving a person's life, and you felt like that was an estimate you could really take to the bank, I think that you would be less likely to want to give $1,000 to a cash transfer, because you'd say it just seems hard to believe that that impact of the transfer will be as large as the saving of a life. Nonetheless, we don't find those estimates to be credible enough that we're willing to say we know these are right and therefore they must be better than cash. There's all sorts of uncertainty around those estimates, and part of our ranking in giving Give Directly or cash transfers as an intervention, the credence that we do is a function of the fact that while we certainly think bed nets do have the best evidence we've seen and the largest impact for a program that needs more money, it's by no means a sure thing. And giving cash has been studied enough in different ways that I think you can be pretty confident that you are helping people. The other thing I just want to note about the intervention is that in the same way there are long-term studies of deworming programs that show effects, there's long-term studies of cash programs that show really, really large effects. And I think that it, and those are high returns on investment, where people get money today and they use it in ways that are intelligent and productive, such that it allows them to spend more money down the line. And these are things that we, returns of like 20% a year don't seem obtainable for us, but people living in Kenya are just living in a very different, very different context than we are. And there are often, I think, many opportunities where they're able to use a little bit of money to solve like a major problem that they have, such that it leads to significant returns down the line. And so when we scan the whole picture, I mean, there's one point which is, you know, we've always been thoughtful about improving lives versus saving lives, and that's a philosophical question. But more broadly, giving cash doesn't seem obviously to be significantly worse than bed nets. It seems like, you know, adjusting one's assumptions a little bit about how the world works and what impacts you get from different programs, you can see them overlapping in terms of their impact.
At the same time, I mean, if people have, you know, we know that donors are going to do what they want, and a lot of what we try to do is be transparent about what the considerations are, what the evidence is. So we're not, you know, we're not claiming, for example, that cash transfers are proven to save lives at all. And so if what you care about is saving lives and you want something that's proven to do that, I mean, we expect donors to, you know, to take that into account. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Alexander, I want
to add a little bit. So, one way to put it is, like, I think that a lot of times when I think about cash transfers, it does, like, there's a hint of, like, feeling like maybe I'm admitting failure. Like, we at Gimbal are trying to find the best data opportunities out there. And if the best data opportunity is, like, writing a check to a poor person, like, man, like, we are just not very good at our job. Like, why aren't there better opportunities out there? And I think that the thing that Ellie just said is like, the way that I sort of resolve that internal, like, conversation that I'm having in my head when that happens, because I really don't think that giving cash to these people in Kenya is quite the same thing as you might imagine giving cash to sort of, like, a homeless guy in New York or something like that. There's some evidence that indicates that they do have really, really high returns. And also, like, I think because it's such a radically different circumstance, we should be somewhat conservative about our ability to sort of know better about what might benefit these people. So things like tin roofs, like, I just would never have told you that, like, a tin roof can have a high return on investment, but it turns out that you have to replace the thatch really often, and over and above having to, like, actually pay to buy the new thatch for your roof, it just sucks to, like, have to move your stuff out of your hut every time it rains. And so that's the kind of thing that, like, no charity is out there giving out tin roofs, but it seems like maybe that is a really, really great way to help somebody, and it's hard to know from us out of our city here in New York, like, exactly how good that is. One of the things that's really cool about Give Directly is that they're doing this randomized control trial to help us assess that question. They seem like amongst the best organizations we've ever seen in terms of trying to answer this question of, you know, what are our transfers achieving? How can we do it better? And I want to sort of also address, while I'm talking, your investing analogy, because I think that there's a weird irony in Give Directly. So one point is the point Ellie just made, which is that if you don't buy any of the cost-effective assessments, if you're just really sort of conservative and skeptical, then Give Directly might look really, really good. The case that, like, basically giving people money helps them seems really strong. So I'm sort of thinking, like, that's an index fund, right? Like, it's the big, like, you're getting the market. Like, whatever people are going to buy, like, that's what you've got. And on the other hand, Give Directly is this, like, relatively young, new, really ambitious organization where, like, we feel like they're, like, they are amongst the sort of most transparent, most interesting, highest potential upside organizations we've ever seen. And so that's where your analogy to sort of, like, all of a sudden we're investing in these tech startups comes in. And I think that those are sort of both true. On the intervention side, you've sort of got this, like, index fund, and on the organizational side, you've got this risky startup. And so as a donor, your risk profile could be kind of at either end of the spectrum, and you would still want to think, you can still think that GiveDirect is a really good buy. And I just want to sort of point it out. It's a weird tension between those two things. Luckily for us, like, we wouldn't feel so good about an organization that was sort of the startup, that was also doing a startup intervention. We like this as a sort of core, easily proven intervention. Sorry.
Maybe just quickly, a couple other examples of how people are using money might be helpful. Because we keep talking about this tin roofs, and I think a lot of people would purchase tin roofs and only receive the first half of their transfer. That's just one thing to keep in mind. They also sometimes bought livestock with that money and paid for school fees. Livestock is a good example of something that's sort of an investment. It's income generating because some people said they were planning to sell their milk or dairy products, and also could sell it off in the future when they needed more cash on hand. Another example that comes to mind is that we met a man who had been a motorbike driver. That was his occupation. But every day he had to rent his motorbike for about 300 shillings, and he was only taking in 300 to 500 shillings, he told us. And that was before he got the transfer, and once he got the transfer, he used it to purchase his own motorbike. So now he doesn't pay the rental fee. So those are just a couple other ways we can be thinking about. By far and above, tin roofs are by far the most common, but those are, like, some other uses of money.
we don't want to be turning this into like an anecdote sale of an intervention, though. I mean, what these anecdotes are meant to do is I think illustrate something that it's easy to miss when you're making analogies to American poor, which I think is actually an incredibly misleading analogy for like a whole lot of reasons. And that's that, you know, to get a huge return on investment, to do something that really transforms your life, you don't actually need to be like brilliant. You don't need to have some incredible, you know, market investment opportunity the way that you might to get a 20% return in America. If you're that short on wealth and you're that strapped, it could be something as simple as, you know, you're paying for a motorcycle by the day and now you buy it. There's a lot of things that I've bought that just they probably had like massive returns on investment. They made me more efficient. They saved me time. I never thought of them that way because I don't have that kind of liquidity issue where I've like never had, you know, that much cash at once to buy something simple like an ice cube tray or something. So I think that's what the anecdotes do for me. I don't want those to be sold as the case for cash.
Two questions following up on two different things we've been discussed. The first, back all the way back to the evaluating people question. Aside from evaluating what people are actually demonstrably doing, why should we believe that you're any good at evaluating people?
You mean in terms of when we talk about how good the organization is? Mm-hmm. Sure. So, I mean, that's just... Right. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
And then the second is, I mean, there are pockets in the United States, Appalachia, urban Mississippi, where life expectancy and qualities are essentially equivalent to Western Kenya. So if there was a gift directly that was transposed directly into one of those environments, where there's some objective measurement that says, would you think that it was an organization to consider? I mean, is there something else sort of, because in there, you know, keep talking about the analogy is wrong, and, you know, right, the analogy to the average homeless guy you see on the street, you have no idea who's there or whether he's actually homeless and all those sorts of things is right, but I'm not quite sure that an analogy to someone in the United States in a pocket of deep and entrenched poverty is actually all that different.
Okay, so we had two questions. One, why should people believe we're any good at evaluating people when we talk about absent what we already do in terms of evaluating what they're doing. And the second question, which I'll just take them in order, is, you know, is it really true that the analogy to the American poor is bad? What would we think about an organization like this that was working in parts of the U.S. where standards of living are really comparable to the developing world? So on the first question, I mean, we have found, like, the reason we talk about our opinions about people and our confidence in the organization is that we found it playing a role in where we would give our own money and in who we feel confident about. And the thing that I just, you know, I think this comes back to that fundamental philosophy of GiveWell, is that I can't imagine us starting to make recommendations that don't reflect where we would give our own personal money. That's just, like, that's the line I won't cross. You know, in terms of what I mean is the part of our own personal money that's intended to make the world a better place, and that's all it's intended to do. So I'm not going to recommend my friend's, you know, organization because I gave to them because I wanted to be nice to them. But there's a budget that I have for giving to charity to do as much good as I can. I can't imagine putting out a recommendation that was just ignoring things that went into that. And so that's why we talk about our opinions on people. We've written about what our opinions on people and organizations are based on, and I think it's pretty concrete, but not as concrete as like it would be in a perfect world. But it's based on things like, you know, we ask a lot of tough questions. How good are the answers? And we usually give examples when we don't think the answers are good or are going to be. We're going to be writing more content about this. We also talk about, you know, how easy has it been for us to get the information we need? Have we had a lot of miscommunications? Have the communications been efficient? Do we feel that this organization is, you know, is basically very on board with and devoted to and efficient about transparency and sharing what it learned, or does it feel like it's just too long a process to get the information that we need out of it? So these are things that, you know, and how have we seen them adapt? How have we seen them answer the challenges? These are things that enter into our opinions. Usually you can read them between the lines of our reviews, but we are going to start being more explicit about them and writing more about them. And people can weigh them how they want, which is another reason we've tried to be transparent. So, you know, our view on the people running GiveDirectly is a major reason that it's number two instead of number three or not ranked at all. Our view on AMF and GiveDirectly versus SCI is a major reason that SCI is number three. SCI is a great organization. We do not recommend organizations that we don't think are great, but we think there's a difference. And so if you want to discount that and you want to say, well, I don't really care what they think about people, I care how they analyze evidence, then we've made it pretty clear, and I think we even say explicitly in today's blog post what you should do if you think that, which charities you should give more to and which you should give less to. So that's the answer on evaluating people.
Well, then you didn't answer the question.
Yep. Okay.
Why should we trust your judgment in the first place? Like, okay, if we don't trust you, then we can do something different. But, why should we trust it?
So in terms of why should anyone trust GiveWell about anything? I mean, you should always there's to some extent.
Pause there. I mean, there's a record of the kind of just research that you've always done, which is these types of studies produce replicable results over time. Lots of information has been based on those, and there's did X happen? And yes, X happened. There's a different thing, which is saying, okay, now we're evaluating how we feel about the people, and evaluating people is even harder than evaluating social programs. So what's the evidence that your criteria, your ability to measure those criteria, are actually indicative of good people?
Right. I mean, I think the
question of, what's the evidence that GiveWell's criteria are criteria that lead to better charities is a question that, you could ask all along since GiveWell got started, you should still be asking. There's no evidence, right? That's very concrete that, GiveWell definitely makes better decisions about where to give than other options that you have. I mean, all you have is the conclusions that we reach, the recommendations that we make, and then our best attempts to follow up after the fact and see the extent to which those decisions were right or wrong. And what I'm saying, what we're trying to say now is that, we think that this component of our analysis and conclusions of, how well the people communicate with us, how easy it is to get information, how good those answers appear to be. I think that will be a major part of whether we 2 years from now think the recommendations we're making today were good, in the same way that, 3 years ago we thought that a certain level of evidence for the intervention was extremely important.
So the answer I'd give, if you want a simple answer, why should we trust you? I mean, I would just recommend that you do the following. Read our blog, read some of the content on our website, consider coming to one of our research meetings, talk to us. And I think that there's enough there that there's a decent case to be made that we're good critical thinkers that you would be happy kind of outsourcing certain decisions to, and you would say, okay, I've spot checked these guys, I've seen what they do, I've seen how they think, and I don't have the time to do the kind of work they're doing myself, so I want to put weight on their opinions. That's a conclusion you may come to, and if you don't, then we've told you, how to respond to that. So I don't think we're actually very explicitly not trying to stake our recommendations or everything about us on people buying into this, but they do affect where we give, therefore they affect how we rank things, and we're transparent about that, and we think that there's actually a great deal of material available for assessing the quality of GiveWell staff.
Can I add one other thing, which is that, venture capitalist friends have told me that you get to be a good judge of people as a venture capitalist by just seeing hundreds of companies. And, over time, your intuition about these things gets better. And I think, GiveWell has done a similar thing by talking to hundreds of charities and having hundreds of conversations. And, I think they're still new at it, but unlike maybe your average venture capitalist who's just trusting their intuition, they're trying to kind of formalize what they think are the things that intuition is based on, and write about it, be transparent about it, and feedback about it. So.
I don't believe venture capitalists.
Cool. Sounds good.
Can I just throw another comment on that? I mean, I think one bias. I think this is important to at least try to do. I mean, I think one bias one can easily fall into is just focus on what's easily measurable. And that can almost be the worst bias. I mean, you can lose things. Yeah.
Right. That's what we're trying. That's a tough line to walk. But again, I mean, we've chosen to go the route of giving the best giving recommendations we can instead of giving the most kind of objective formulaic recommendations. And that's the way that we're going. So.
In terms of just a couple of things, in terms of the people, I think that it's reasonable that you would feel, and probably are correct, that you're good at judging organizations and people in organizations. I think it's worth noting, though, that your standard of evidence is different than the standard of evidence you are in the outcome research you do. And so one might get led to the point of view that because you feel that you can evaluate people intuitively and from experience in a subjective way, which is, I think, valid, although not perfect, has to be part of what you do. One could come to the reasonable conclusion that you should use some of that intuition about what's going on in the world to save lives.
Right.
That doesn't use the same level of scientific, quote unquote, proof
right.
that you're using that leads you to recommend as a number two organization giving directly instead of organizations that one's intuition would actually tell you must be saving lives as opposed to being able to prove they're saving lives. So I think there's a contradiction in your own, I mean, I'm just pointing this out in my mind.
Sure.
There's a contradiction in the level of proof that you require on the one hand versus the other hand. I think you're perfectly entitled and probably very confident to judge people. But you might be equally confident to use your intuition to judge what causes out there are likely saving lives, whether they're incremental surgeries or, quite frankly, whether they're tin roofs in Bolivia, which will save lives. My intuition tells me that fewer people will die in Bolivia if they're tin roofs than if they're thatch roofs. I think there's pretty good scientific evidence to show that that's the case. Whether they want thin tin roofs in Bolivia, in rural Bolivia, is a whole other question, and the political
sure.
obstacles to doing that are manifold. But I do think the main point I'm trying to make here is that you're using a couple of different standards of proof, and that whether you want to or not, you've affected your brand perception with your choice of being directly. And to some people who are committed to spreading the word about good wealth and saving lives, it undermines potentially the value of the brand to us. And I actually love GiveWell and have been thinking more and more about ways to spread the brand much more widely than the narrow way you define your audience. And I think it could be a much more accessible, and it should be, because there should be more people giving. So anyway, that's a long answer, but I think there's two main points I'm making. One is that your intuition is probably good and you should probably use it more, and particularly in choosing who to study and what types of organizations might be saving lives, as opposed to just improving lives, which only giving directly must do, absolutely must do. And then the other point is brand perception isn't something you control. And you've affected your brand in a fairly significant way by your choice. I think you're very thoughtful people, so you've done it quite self-consciously, but it's a problem for some of us.
So the comment was basically that we're, and again, I'm going to summarize so this may not capture
I'm sorry
everything. Yeah, no problem.
But I think there are important summaries of points that are being made around the table.
Yeah, sure. Appreciate it. So the point that's being made is A, that we are using our intuitions about people as part of our thinking. Maybe we should use our intuitions about evidence as well, about what saves lives, about what works, because it seems somewhat inconsistent for us to be kind of very scientific and all about the facts when it comes to evidence, but not so much when it comes to judging people. So that was the first point. I think I'll start by responding to that. I think we do use our intuitions when it comes to figuring out what works. And I would be interested to see where people think that we're doing things that go against our intuitions, because we actually have asked ourselves this a lot. What are the interventions that I can't prove are working, but I think are working? And, you know, there is not much that we've come up with. And basically where we're coming from is that we do feel intuitively, but also because, you know, we've been convinced by empirical arguments that you get more bang for your buck in the developing world, but that creates an issue where you have a huge distance between the donor and the people. And so I really don't particularly have the intuition that most things work. My intuitions do say that giving people money makes their lives better. There are some other things, like actually the example you gave, the fistula surgery, where we haven't looked at all the randomized controlled trials, but I mean, that's something that we would be interested in if we could find the incrementality. But there aren't a lot of things, and I think for most interventions you could name that we don't have at the top of our list, I think I can tell you why our intuitions actually aren't so keen on it and why we would need more evidence to really believe in it. So I don't think that we're really giving our intuitions short shrift. I think that is a common, I mean, you could call it a misperception about GiveWell, you could call it our fault for branding ourselves that way by on purpose or by accident, but, you know, a lot of people think GiveWell is evidence first, and are surprised to see intuition creep in. And really, GiveWell has always been about deciding where we would give our own personal money, and that has led us to ask for evidence, because I think in a lot of these cases we just don't know enough to feel confident in something when we haven't seen the evidence. That's on the first point. The second point, I mean, it's basically a comment that we're affecting our brand by recommending Give Directly. And I think that's clearly true. I think it is not necessarily something that we anticipated being true to the extent that it's turning out to be true. And I'm not really sure exactly why it is, and so it's something that we'll probably be having more conversations about. I tend not to be too concerned about it because the philosophy of GiveWell all along has been to, you know, be honest about where we would give and why, make the most honest case we can, be trustworthy, be authentic, and, you know, figure the messaging out around that. So I don't think we've ever regretted the decision to, you know, to go with where we would actually give and to say what we actually think. But it's certainly something, I mean, if it's causing brand problems, we can figure out why that is, whether there's a real problem behind it, and whether there's something we can do about it without sacrificing that.
I mean, when I feel like I reflect on this question of weighing potential brand risk, of, like, recommending a new type of organization against following, you know, a more rigid set of criteria within which we're allowed to evaluate organizations, I'm much more frightened of GiveWell following a predefined set of criteria and not continuing to evolve as we find organizations that, you know, we think are good and we want to give to. And, you know, the benefit, I think, of being transparent about why we're doing what we're doing and, you know, where we think people should give is that if it turns out that the discomfort with Give Directly is a fundamental mistake that we've made in recommending them, well, then we'll learn that, and we'll have learned something about which organizations we think are the ones that are worth giving to, and, you know, ultimately we'll change our minds. And if we don't, you know, and instead we've altered slightly what GiveWell is in the audience that it appeals to, but nonetheless we're identifying great organizations to support, and I'm much happier with that outcome than avoiding an organization that is great just because it's different.
Could you give some advice to someone who, you know, really resonates with the Peter Singer approach and is, you know, trying to kind of reconcile how Give Directly, how this shift fits with that and how they should tell their friends about it?
Sure. Yeah, so the advice to someone, the question, can we give advice to someone who's really, you know, on the Peter Singer approach? They think that's what's going to appeal to their friends. And I assume the Peter Singer approach here means something like cost per life saved. You can save a life for this many dollars. What advice would we give to that person to think about this and to tell their friends? You know, I think there's two things that simultaneously should be happening for a donor who is finding themselves a little bit lost in terms of where we're going and why we're there. I think one is just to try to understand it, to engage in the dialectic, because I do think the natural way things are going to go is that we came into this endeavor with the same level of background knowledge as a lot of people who are not professional aid people and don't have time to really engage. But now we have learned a lot, and we are, you know, further along the spectrum toward professional aid people who tend to think about things very differently. I don't think that it's a good solution for people who are kind of casual, who are just getting started, to stay exactly where they are. I think it's a good thing to have that dialectic, to try to understand why we're disagreeing. To the extent that we're wrong, we will hopefully move. To the extent that you're wrong, you can hopefully learn. So I think that's a very important thing to be doing. You know, but if you're not convinced, I'm not asking people to just blindly trust us, and I think that it's perfectly legitimate to say, I want to save a life. I am not sold on this other stuff yet. I'm giving 100% of my donation to AMF, and when I tell people about GiveWell, I'm going to tell them about AMF, the AMF review, the AMF cost per life saved estimate. We recommend 70% of donations go to AMF. It's our number one charity, and that's the only one where we think there's really evidence of lives being literally saved. So I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, and I think our website is reasonably set up for doing it, but if it's not, we welcome suggestions.
I think I would, and I'm very new, and I'm really was influenced by Phil in kind of your analytical approach, because I'm actually more, I like the cash transfer, I don't have an issue with it, but what I hear is very different. It's kind of like, well, that could work great. And that's where I came from before.
Right.
And so that's probably the conflict I'm having, is that I'd like, you know, I would come to you to say, why? Like, I know a zillion cash transfer programs, churches, all over the place there are cash transfers. So maybe if you kind of said, well, why are, do they stand out?
Right.
Any, because almost to me it sounds like you had a friend who was on that group and I've never heard of them. Or,
right.
You know, to prevent that, you might want to give more
right.
information about why the 100,000 other cash transfer groups out there
right.
aren't as good.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because
I right.
I like your
right.
research approach.
Right.
And that's, because that's what I would trust.
Right.
And do trust, but maybe people would benefit from more information.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. So the comment is, you know, we should be talking more about why give directly and not why, you know, why not one of the many cash transfer programs out there, and, you know, why this organization. So, I mean, I guess my quick answer on the why is that there's a big difference between U.S. cash transfers and developing world cash transfers. And that's something we have written about. We could perhaps highlight it more, but I do think a lot of Americans are maybe not fully aware of just, like, how wide the chasm is between what poverty means in the U.S. and what poverty means in Kenya. They're really, I mean, to me, they're just entirely different concepts and just don't really intersect at all. This is, you know, Give Directly is the only organization we have been able to find that is devoted to cash transfers in the developing world. So that's, I mean, that's the quick answer, and maybe that's something we could be doing a better job highlighting.
Some schools do cash transfers, but it's like 20% of what they do is cash transfers.
Yeah, it's usually much less. I mean, it's common in refugee situations, like in disaster relief situations, to give some cash transfers. But the idea of kind of like peacetime.
But
you
if
know,
you just say, like, I want, I mean, something that I think we, you know, we were very, I would say one of the things that has most surprised me since, you know, I started 6.5 years ago as just, you know, an analyst at an investment firm who wanted to give some money to charity, and 6.5 years later were these full-time people working on this question of where should I give, is 6.5 years ago I would have said, well, if you want to give to bed nets, it's easy to find an organization that's going to take money and buy bed nets. You want to give to vaccines, it's easy to do that. Cash, it should be easy to do that. And one of the things we found most challenging is just finding these organizations that are largely trying to take in money and do more of the good things that they do. And that applies to bed nets and deworming. These two organizations we have found that we think do that. It also applies to all these other great programs that we wish we could support, but we haven't been able to find. And if you, I mean, we could have a nice little set of blog posts we've written over the years of the time that, you know, when I started out, I wanted to give to a water charity that was digging wells and could show that the wells were still there a year later and the water was clean and people were getting healthier. Well, guess what? I couldn't find it. That was actually the thing that got me most interested in GiveWell and led me to leave my job at the investment firm and do this. But that wasn't easy. And similarly, it hasn't been easy to find immunizations or salt iodization or cash transfers until a year ago. And so you can go back on our blog and see things we wrote in 2008 and 2009 and early 2011. Why can't we find an organization that's giving out cash? This is such a great thing. We'd be really interested if we found this because it would be really promising. And it was only a year and a half ago that we did find it.
Yeah, I mean, we wrote publicly asking for this. So, you know, another thing that I want to add on Ellie's point, I mean, it is interesting, and I'm a little, you know, I think about this a lot because it is true. We have looked for organizations that it's like, here's $100, buy $100 worth of stuff, deliver it. It's a very rare model, and maybe for a good reason. And that is something that I'm thinking about a lot because it's just, you know, on one hand, you want to say, well, I really want accountability. I want to see exactly where my money goes. But when you talk to aid professionals, a lot of them are just like, well, organizations aren't set up that way because that's like not a good way to do aid. I mean, so what the way it works is that if a program is that proven and you want to roll it out to everyone, then you should be working through the government. And who should be working through the government? It should be governments. And so like the U.S. and British and Canadian government are working with the governments of Malawi and Kenya to make sure that they get a national program in place that covers everyone they can cover, right? There's not really a place in here for someone to make an online donation of $1,000 and now we get a few extra nets. And then meanwhile, they also don't tend to think those are the best things to do anyway, that is the best use of dollars. So, you know, we'll talk to someone who works in water and sanitation, and they're like, if you just go and spend your money digging wells, that's just like a really stupid way to spend your money. You could be building capacity. You could be training government officials. You could be going for leverage. These are more risky things. These are not proven things. And so I'm not sure exactly what to do with this, because I'm very far from convinced that these aid professionals are wrong. In fact, I would guess that they're probably right. And if we spent enough time on it, we'd probably end up agreeing with them. And so it's a matter of trying to, you know, do we stay where we are and say, no, we want this way of doing charity, even if it's not really the way that makes the most sense, because it's the one we can quantify? Or are we going to help people starting there come along and understand why it should be done a different way? But we're not there yet. I mean, we're still on this model currently of delivering. And I think we'll probably, in the end, my vision for GiveWell long term is that we'll do both. My vision for GiveWell long term is that there will be the part that says, look, if you are in this, you know, initial stage of donating and you want your dollars to go to something, we found the organizations that can do it. But if you're willing to take some bigger risks, take some bigger flyers, and take some more trust in us, because it'll probably be necessary, then these are the things we actually would give our money to.
Okay, so this may be...
I came to GiveWell, I think, less looking for, like, maximum number of lives saved, but more for, like, maximum good per dollar and good broadly construed. And that's where I think, for me, GiveDirectly seems of a piece with the other stuff that you do, which is your sense from looking at it that I think is the same principle that's always operational for you about where you give your money, that it seems most likely to have the biggest positive impact. And, like, it's obviously super complicated to say what a positive impact is, but a lot of what this reflects is humility about, like, people, you know, often know for themselves what would have the biggest positive impact, and this, like, goes directly to the biggest expert on how to help oneself or what have you. And I think that, like, in a sense, I guess communicating that underlying principle is helpful. Or when I thought about it, I found it helpful in understanding that you weren't, like, bringing it to
right.
place.
Yeah, I think that's true. The quick comment was kind of, you know, when you think about maximum good per dollar instead of cost per life saved, GiveDirectly may make a bit more sense. And I was a bit surprised at the surprise we got, because, you know, SCI has been our number two charity for a while, and they're not saving any lives, or certainly not very many, or not something that we can quantify. So the improving saving thing, I guess I didn't realize that was still a major distinction in a lot of people's minds, but. So I feel like there might be more to the GiveDirectly situation, and we're still trying to understand exactly what it is.
If you have a number one charity, why do you recommend giving to other places in addition to that? Like, why isn't it just 100% we're going to funnel it into to AMM?
So the question was, if we have a number one charity, why do we tell someone to give any money anywhere else? And I think it's a good question, because a lot of the reasons people split their donations, I think, are not actually very good reasons when you're trying to do as much good as possible. You know, in investing, you want to diversify, you want to reduce risk, you don't want to lose all your money. In giving, I don't think that's at least not for me. I mean, I just want, you know, to do the most good, the most expected good. But I think there is another reason to give to multiple organizations. And the reason is easier to think about when, instead of thinking about yourself giving, you know, a certain amount of money, you think about GiveWell directing several million dollars. If you're directing several million dollars, if you give it all to one organization versus three, well, if you give it to three, that's three organizations that are basically learning opportunities, that you can see, you know, what happened to that money. You get a closer seat at their table. You get to follow them more closely. You learn a lot more. And so there's actual really tangible benefits to supporting multiple organizations. And so that's what it looks like from GiveWell's perspective. And that's why when we say, well, it would be best if the GiveWell money could be divided up in this way, instead of all given to one charity. Now, why should you as an individual split your money? The reason I would give is just that if the GiveWell fans do that, then we'll get a good outcome. And if the GiveWell fans all say, no, I'm just giving to my favorite, then we'll get a much more distorted outcome. That's maybe kind of weird reasoning to some of you, and it's up to you whether to accept it, but I accept it. And I think it makes sense to give in proportions that you would like to see the larger universe of GiveWell donors reflect. Because if everyone does that, we'll get the right proportions, and if they don't, we won't.
I just want to clarify, you said the opposite on the blog today, that if everyone gives 70, 20, 10, because you said so, that would be distorted relative to if everyone, you know, looked over your evidence and gave to what their favorite is.
Right.
Then that would be kind of a check on your
right
split.
So I didn't mean to put it exactly that way. Instead of repeating the question, I'll just say exactly what we tried to communicate in the blog post, which is that if everyone gives in the proportion that they would like to see the larger community given, then what we'll end up is kind of a weighted average. Well, it's like everyone's voting with their dollars, and we'll get kind of the right answer. If everyone just says, well, you know, my money is not going to make a difference to GiveWell's learning, so I'm just going to give it all to one. If everyone does that, we'll just get some distorted allocation that doesn't really reflect that sort of a vote. Then the question, should you give to GiveWell's recommended proportions or just your own favorite proportions? I mean, I would go with the second and put weight on what GiveWell says as much as you want to. I mean, again, this is that question. Do you want to, you know, how much weight do you want to put on our opinions of the organization? And we've tried to give some guidance on how to change your donation as that changes.
So a lot of the conversations about individual organizations and programs, interventions so far, has focused on why there's potentially a gap or a shortcoming in an individual program, you know, based on some element in the value chain, like, AMF is great because there's a need for nets. There's already a distribution logistics system in place, but they need nets, so let's create nets or supply nets via that system. Village Reach has good logistics, but the same problem applies. There aren't enough vaccines. So I'm wondering whether you guys have thought about the individual charity analyses in sort of a more horizontal way, instead of thinking about sort of individual program or individual charities, but are there systematic problems in terms of where an intervention might cut across a number of different charities? And I think that in some ways sort of extends to the more general conversations about what else is GiveWell doing and sort of what are the other areas of charity that you're contemplating right now.
Sure. So the basic question was, you know, we look at organizations that fill in one part of the value chain. Have we thought about organizations that are kind of more horizontal, that kind of, you know, contribute in a more subtle way to a lot of interventions? You know, we've done what we've done for, I think, reasons we've been over tonight, which is that we look for things that can be traced, that can be quantified. We tried to start in the easiest place. That's why we started where we did. We wanted to find charities we could be confident in without too much knowledge, and that means basically relying on academic evidence, things like that. But, yeah, I mean, we're open to other things. The more you get away from this kind of vertical, you know, defined value added, the harder it gets to measure things. And I think that's a real issue. I think that all else equal, I will give to something that's measurable over something that's not. That's not because I have a rule about it. It's not because I promise to do it. It's because I have more confidence in things I can measure. But there's a point at which, you know, something is a compelling enough need that I would give to it, even though it's less measurable than something else, and we're looking for that point, and that might be a good segue into the next section of the meeting, which is talking about our, you know, our work and other causes, but maybe we should make sure we've covered the questions on top charities first.
Go for it.
Cool. All right, so other causes. So GiveWell, yeah, I mean, just we've definitely, throughout our history, we've been in this mode of, you know, dollars, and I'm just going to pull a little outline I have here, but We've definitely been in this mode of, you know, you take your dollars and you translate them into directly into improved lives in a quantitative way. I think our larger vision is definitely to be figuring out how to give to accomplish as much good as possible with no restrictions on that. And so what we want, the value we want to add is we want to be very critical, very analytical, to have a lot of information, and basically to spend a lot more time on this than our donors are able to spend themselves. And we want to talk about it in a way that brings them along and helps them share in the conversation, rather than just saying, you know, we're such and such big name foundation, trust us. That's our long-term vision. That requires getting into some causes that are much harder to measure. And so we started doing that this year. And we originally launched this thing we called GiveWell Labs, which was basically everything that doesn't fit into this Peter Singer framework. We had called GiveWell Labs. We said it was going to be 25% of our work. I think at this point, we don't really see things that way anymore. We've kind of divided our work into, you know, finding these direct dollars to outcomes interventions and then, like, everything else. And so now I'm going to talk about everything else. And I think it is and has to be a major part of what we're working on, because I think that down the line, to do the best giving we can and have the best impact we can, we have to do this. It could be a very long a very long road to understand this stuff and to do a good job with it, but I think we have to do it. So we've been working closely with a foundation called Good Ventures, which we've written about a couple times, and they're basically, you know, they're a foundation that's going to do a good amount of giving in the future, and they have kind of helped us in terms of helping us get into certain conversations, and basically, you know, we've also just been working with them in terms of being more efficient because we share a lot of the same priorities and we share this vision of doing the most good possible, finding the best causes, and being transparent about it. There's basically three categories that we've engaged in this year of this broad other causes mission. One of them is trying to learn more about the big foundations that exist today and just really try to understand how they think, what they think the best projects are, why they think it, and how those projects go. Because this seems like a very logical thing to do. I mean, you know, when you're just starting off, you want to look at the people who've been doing it for a while, who have a lot more resources, a lot more experience, see what you can learn from them. This is a place where we've been basically piggybacking off the work of Good Ventures. So Good Ventures has been talking to these foundations, trying to learn from them, and in one case so far, and potentially other cases, it's been doing co-funding, which means that Good Ventures and like the Gates Foundation are both putting in some of the funding for this project in Myanmar to fight malaria medicine resistance. And so that process, we've been involved in it, we've been involved in the conversations, and we've been looking for ways to take as much as possible of what we're learning and get it in a form where we can share it with the world. That's not always easy work. Some of these foundations are sensitive about public communications. And so we have been, you know, kind of trying to figure out, okay, at what point should we be trying to make things transparent? At what point are we just doing exploratory work? And for that reason, at this point, we don't have a lot to share. I can make some very general comments about it if people want. But it's not something that, at this point, we've produced a lot of, like, transparent, you know, this is what we've learned. But we will, and I do believe we will. I think our strategy for doing it is fine, but, you know, for now, I'm mostly just letting you know that we're doing that, and that it's one of the main ways of trying to learn about other causes. The second category that we've been engaging in is what we call strategic cause selection. So the idea here is that if you look at a major foundation and you go to the front page of their website, you'll see issues. And they'll be like U.S. education, cancer research, environment. And when you ask the foundation, how did you choose those issues? The usual answer you get is that there's a person who funded this foundation and they were really interested in this thing, or this is their personal passion, so we picked it. We think that there may be a better way. We want to pick causes based on their potential for impact and based only on that. And this is, obviously, it's not objective, it's subjective. We're using a lot of our intuitions, our judgment calls, but it's still very, we're hoping for something very different from, well, I was very interested in the environment, so I started off right there. We're instead trying to look across the landscape, look at all the causes, and figure out, based on the information we can gather, which are the right ones to be in. And I think it's likely that we are going to want to pick causes and specialize in them, at least for large periods of time, and then step back and refresh, because from what I've seen of the large funders, I think they get a lot of good advantages out of doing this. I think there are real advantages to this, and if you try to do everything just by, you know, asking questions with no context, it will not get you as far as they've gotten. So that's something we've been trying to do. Some of our strategies... We've done some review of the history of philanthropy, a list of its supposed success stories. We've also done a fair amount of analysis of where philanthropic dollars go today. What are the popular causes? What are the unpopular causes? And our kind of ideal is a cause that's very promising, very logical for philanthropy, but not very popular. And that kind of has a gap and that not enough people are funding it. So that's our ideal. We have a list of causes that look like they might be promising for various reasons. And a lot of them, we're going in and just doing a very basic level investigation. So, you know, taking the biggest question about the cause and trying to analyze it and get the answer to it, or talking to the biggest people in the cause, asking them some questions and revisiting. A couple that we can talk about if people are interested, we haven't published on them yet, but we will. Migration, so there's this interesting idea that people can benefit a lot from migrating to urban areas in the developing world, from rural to urban, and kind of promoting this, educating people about it. This is something we don't see foundations working on, and yet this is an example of something that is intuitively appealing to us. I wouldn't give to it now, but it's something that, you know, there has been one study on it. The study was pretty promising, and it's something that I'd be interested in maybe learning more about, doing more research on. And then we've also looked into climate change, and we've got some preliminary thoughts on climate change that, that we can share. So that's number two. So the number one thing we've been doing is talking to other foundations. Number two is this kind of looking across the universe of causes, trying to figure out which are the most promising ones. The third one is that we have wanted to be going in depth on a cause at the same time as we've been doing this broad overview. We think that that's the right way to do it, is to be in parallel and not just to, you know, I think if you stay broad and you never dive in, you're going to miss a lot of insight about what happens when you get to know more about a cause and what the actual strategy is going to look like. So there's this cause meta research that we focused on for a few reasons. One is that it's something that we have run up against in our research, is that we're trying to make sense of what the proven interventions are, and we've got a study, and the study makes these claims, but we can't look at the raw data. We can't look at the code because it's not shared. Well, why aren't people sharing the code, and why aren't people sharing the data behind their studies so others can analyze them and learn from them? Another thing, I mean, we'll see a study and it'll say, well, we looked at these, you know, 30, 50 outcomes, and we found, you know, an effect on income for, like, women between the ages of 18 and 25 or something. I mean, this is a slight exaggeration, but we're saying, okay, how many different analyses did you run here before you got the one that looked good? Why wasn't this kind of very logical practice of pre-registration followed, where someone declared what they were looking for before they got the data in a public way that people could go back and check it? So we've run up against this issue, and we call this issue meta-research, which is the idea that there's this academic research system. It does a lot of good. It's really valuable. But in some ways, it plays by its own rules. It's not necessarily designed to create maximum social value. And what would it look like if it were? And could a funder encourage it to look more that way? Obviously, this area appealed to us because we ran into it, which I know sounds a little bit like the personal interest thing. And in some ways, it is, because we're trying to go in depth here. It's not that we've proven this is the best cause. But I also think it reflects that it's a real problem, and the combination of that and the fact that we don't see many other funders working on it. That's not to say there are none, but compared to all the other causes we've seen that look preliminarily interesting to us, this one, there's nothing else that kind of seems to be as big as this one, like the most room for improvement, and also has so few and such new funders working on it. It's generally, you know, there are other groups, but they're just as new to it as we are, and that's interesting. And finally, we just think this will be a good entry point, or we've hoped it would be a good entry point to understanding more about funding research in general, which we think is something that we really have to get better at. So we've done a fair amount of work on meta research. We're in an informal partnership with one major funder, not Good Ventures. It's an anonymous funder, and we've been kind of with them talking to scholars in development economics, trying to feel out the landscape. What are the options for a funder? What are the good strategies for meta research? And we've had a lot of twists and turns, and we've changed our mind a fair amount. We're going to be writing about it in the future, but I can give a summary now if people want. And we've also, you know, we've done things like looking at the Cochrane collaboration, which is actually in medical literature, but we've used their work in the past. We think it's high quality. They're a group that kind of looks at all the studies on a topic, says which ones are good, which ones are bad, and tries to create a meta-analysis that gives an overall picture of whether an intervention works. So, like, we relied on their work for bed nets, because there's 22 randomized controlled trials, and they did a synthesized analysis of them. So that's meta-research. As far as future plans, I think we're going to continue on this path, and I think it could be a long time before it bears giving recommendations, but I think that's a good reason to get started on it now. And I think if and when it produces giving recommendations, they may have to be presented very differently and walled off from the kind of, you know, the bread and butter of GiveWell, or at least what people know as the bread and butter now. Two other things that we want to do. One is we really need to make sure that we're making progress on understanding the world of funding research. I think we understand the world of direct aid pretty well at this point, U.S. and international. We've learned a lot about it. It took us years to get to the point where I was happy with our research and recommendations on this. And it could take years or more to understand scientific research. But I think we need to just understand that landscape. And then another landscape we need to understand is political advocacy. that is something that's even further down the line. The brand issues there are obvious, and that's not something we're thinking about now. But if you look at what big philanthropy does, it's scientific research funding, it's political advocacy funding, and it's direct aid, and it usually falls into one of those three categories. We know a lot about one of them. We know almost nothing about the other two, and so we need to start learning. And some of that learning could take the form of learning grants, where you give to learn. You give, that gets you more access to an organization, gets you better learning opportunities. It's different from a GiveWell recommendation that says this is the most direct good you can do with your dollar. It's a learning grant. And that's something where, you know, we're not sure exactly how that'll work, but certainly working with Good Ventures is helpful there because Good Ventures, you know, can make learning grants.
Where do you see, where do you see times being split up between, in 2013, between picking top charities and the other projects?
So the question is, how do we see time being split up between looking for top charities according to our traditional criteria and exploring these new causes? I think we see it mostly as a personnel distinction, that basically we have, it's kind of like a lot of the new causes are very, it's like we don't even know where to start, and often when we don't know where to start, I'm the one who works on it. And so that's like an example of how we've decided to allocate the time. I guess I wouldn't, you know, this is something that we'll probably be writing more about how exactly we do this allocation. But one thing that we're definitely trying to do is kind of max out to a reasonable degree the work on finding the traditional top charities that we want to be kind of, we feel like we've done a significant proportion of what you can reasonably do to find the kind of top charities we're looking for, and we're going to continue doing that. We're going to continue revisiting the ones that we've got, looking into the interventions that we haven't looked into yet, but I think that it's going to be largely, you know, we have to make sure that we have enough of those top charities to meet demand, and we need to be moving forward on those pretty fast, and then it's kind of like what's left over goes into the other causes.
So, like, you know, our staff capacity has grown a lot over the last couple of years, and that means that we have some more time available for looking into different things, and it just remains like a really important goal of GiveWell as an organization that we maintain a great list of recommendations that meet the traditional GiveWell criteria of direct ways to improve lives. And that both means continuing to update what we have, but also doing the necessary work to look into the areas that we haven't totally exhausted in the way that we would like. And, you know, that's not going to change. And, you know, part of the reason we want to do that is one can make an argument that, well, isn't AMF good enough? I mean, how likely is it that we find something that's in the category of direct aid and so much better than AMF? Well, I do think it's somewhat unlikely because bed nets are so great, the evidence is so strong, and they're so cheap.
And there's a gap.
And we know there's like a big financial gap that is, I mean, if you look at the conversations we've had this year with folks who are leading the efforts to fight malaria worldwide, the thing that comes across in every conversation is that we just need money for nets. I mean, no one's questioning that and saying it's some other bottleneck. At the same time, I think the value of force holding ourselves accountable to trying to find things that are measurable, where if we're wrong, we'll know we're wrong and we'll be able to find out 2 years later, is important to keep us honest as an organization. Because it is a little bit too easy to fall into the trap of, hey, you know, we've done this for a while and we know exactly how things work, so we're going to now rely on our intuitions and forget all that quantitative evidence stuff that we had to do when we first started. We don't want to do that. And, it's going to be challenging for us to maintain the same level of public accountability for the less measurable causes, but making sure that we're continuing to improve on the very measurable causes, I think is really necessary for the organization long term.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how large the financial gap is for AMF?
Well, so the question is about the gap for AMF. So there's two questions. One is the financial gap for NETS worldwide. And then another question is the gap for AMF as an entity, meaning how much money would you feel comfortable giving to this organization? The gap worldwide for NETS is, I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but it's in the $1 billion range, roughly. You have a lot of people who need nets. Nets wear out. They need to get replaced. Nets are $5 a piece, and so, there's a big gap for nets.
And that's per year.
And that's, it's like $1 billion per year. You know, just to give you some sense of where it's at. You know, AMF is a smaller organization, so it's a, you know, it took in $5 million last year. That was its the year in which it took in the largest amount of funding in its history. We would feel comfortable with it getting 2 to 3 times that this year. I think that, you know, this is where these subjective judgments about people matter a whole lot. Mm-hmm. AMF has a track record of giving out money. They clearly don't have a track record of giving out that amount of money. And so therefore the question is, well, what do you now believe about the likelihood of this organization taking in different amounts of money and using it wisely? That's roughly where we're at, where what we think the organization can take in, and given what we expect to happen with donations to our top charities this year, we think that AMF is sufficient room to you know, be comfortable with the amount of money that they specifically will get.
It seems like a good candidate for something that could be much more prospective than funding AMF directly is to fund organizations that promote GiveWell's work or promote AMF or something like that. So I'm thinking of the Life and Save at the moment, which is very young, but that's because I'm involved with it, but there are so Give What We Can as well, or even just spending some of your funding on marketing campaigns to draw attention to GiveWell. Would that be something you'd ever recommend to the average donor to donate towards? Or is that just getting too confusing?
So the question is, would we recommend the average donor donate to basically campaigns that try to convince other people to give to our top charities? I think there's a little bit of a, like, we have to be sensitive to conflict of interest issues. I mean, just putting that right out there. I mean, you know, if we were, right now we recommend AMF. I mean, they distribute bed nets. There's no conflict of interest. It's different if we recommend an organization whose, like, mission is to get people to pay more attention to GiveWell or GiveWell's top charities. On the other hand, if it's an organization that doesn't care about GiveWell's top charities and they're trying to leverage the amount of dollars given to a charity that we aren't confident in, well, that's not as good a case for impact. So, I mean, that's an issue right there. It doesn't mean that we would never, you know, write this is a good organization, but the conflict of interest thing would have heavy effects on how that could be presented and whether it could be in the top charities and stuff like that. You know, as far as like my more, you know, bigger reaction to that, I would say if it were proven in a sense, this is the kind of thing that it seems could be proven. You could have a track record that said, you know, plausibly, like, for every dollar we get, we leverage this many dollars by doing these activities. There's plenty of room to do them more if we had more dollars. That's something that could potentially be a fit for the kind of, you know, the traditional, the casual donor. Anything else, I think, is going to be, you know, that's more in the category of these kind of high risk, high return, heavily intuition driven areas. And I think when it comes to those areas, it actually makes sense to look at comparative advantage and for us, for any given funder to focus on looking into areas that they think they're going to be particularly good at analyzing or that they think they're paying more attention to relative to other funders. And so my intuition is that we wouldn't, you know, that wouldn't be a fit for us because I just don't think that we're good at thinking about marketing. I mean, I think that's, you know, a lot of our talent. I mean, a lot of what's good about GiveWell is how bad we are marketing, in a sense. And so I don't know that that's really the best fit. It's not something that I would be excited to start, you know, really making bets on and say this is a place where I think, you know, this is where I want to be investigating and making my bets.
But I think, I mean, it's important to add that, you know, we want GiveWell's influence to grow a lot. It has always been a goal of ours. It remains a goal of ours. We have and do and will use funding to try and, like, funding of ours, operating funding, to try and spread the message. And, you know, frankly, I think that GiveWell is an interesting, you know, you could go through a very interesting, detailed case study of the challenges around this concept of room for more funding when it comes to using dollars to directly increase influence. Because when we have tried very hard to use money on marketing, and, you know, we haven't used a whole lot, and we haven't put a whole lot of our time, energy, or thoughtfulness into it, but we haven't been very successful at using money to improve our influence. And when we have just killed ourselves with research and tried to figure out the best ways to give money, well, that has always been the most effective marketing. And so every dollar we spent on marketing and every hour we spent on marketing, well, not every, but certainly I look back at the hours spent, and they don't seem well allocated towards the goal of marketing. And the hours we've spent on research not only seem well allocated to finding great charities, but have been the best thing we could have done for marketing, and additional money would have made no difference.
Yeah, and to broaden that a bit, I mean, there is this kind of general observation that if an organization is a good bet to raise more money for AMF in a leveraged way, well, AMF has a fundraising budget. And so that, you know, another thing that we think about when thinking about causes is, who are the constituents here? Who else should be paying for this? If there's a clear constituency that should be paying and they're not, that's probably more a sign that there's something wrong. Whereas there's certain causes where there's just like, there is no constituency except large philanthropy. I think, you know, arguably climate change is one of these. I mean, who benefits enough from the slowing down of climate change to be like, all right, I'm taking this on? It's a very different setup from, you know, raising money for AMF. Well, AMF benefits from that. And another one of those organizations is GiveWell. So that's, you know, that's something we could do without recommending an organization like that. We could use our unrestricted funds, the funds that we can do whatever we want with, and we can just spend them on that because we think it'll leverage our brand and we'll raise more money. And actually our initial thought would be that we're generally avoiding stuff like that because we haven't found it to have good returns for us in the past, but we could be convinced in the future that, you know, to take something on.
Because I would challenge you in that, because my observation from a lot of groups I've worked in is that a good marketer can be amazing if you get the right one.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you have a cause that you really believe in, you know, like my friends don't know about GiveWell, so,
right.
But I'm not a marketer, you know, don't you want the word to spread? So
yeah.
Isn't it, you know, maybe you need somebody outside of your own skill set?
Right.
Who is a salesperson or a marketer? Or, and it's not my field either.
Right. So the question is, I mean, isn't it obvious that we could bring in like a great marketer and they would significantly improve how, you know, how well people know about GiveWell?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't. I wouldn't imply you're doing that, but
no, but I mean,
I hear it from you.
I think it. I mean, it's something that is. I mean, I'm fully in agreement with. I know we could. But the challenge, and you said it exactly, is it has to be the right person. And, you know, it has to be someone we can find who can do this work and do it well for what GiveWell is and who our audience is. And, you know, there's a lot of things about marketing GiveWell that I think make it complicated relative to marketing an average charity or even different types of organizations. And it requires finding, like, a particular person who both is extremely talented at marketing and really gets what it is about GiveWell that needs to be marketed, and that is not something that we have found to be easily identifiable. I mean, if, you know, again, the case study of GiveWell and its marketing is one we could have like a whole long session about, and I would probably enjoy it a lot. I don't know. But, you know, and we had been around for a year in 2008, and our goal so we started in 2007 as a full-time project, and in 2008 our goal was influence, because, you know, we'd been around for 6 months, so we had unbelievable research. Now it's time to market it. And we spent a whole lot of time, and we spent 6 months in 2008 trying to find fundraisers, marketers, trying to build great materials with an outside design firm. And when we put all this effort into that project, you know, not just trying to do it ourselves, but trying to find the right outsider, what we got for it, in hindsight, we felt was a great lesson learned that we should have
right.
focused on research.
They were pretty materials.
But, you know, we remain open to this. I mean, if someone came to us today and was like, I'm the awesome marketer, and I'm ready to do this, and I'm going to convince you, I mean, we would take them because this is a goal of ours. The thing that we're not ready to do is to try to find this person in a search that would just take a huge amount of the organization's resources that right now we feel really need to be devoted to answering these very important questions about, we want to give, you know, I'm going to give a significant portion of the charity I give this year to give directly. I'm pretty sure that's the right decision. But I want to think it through, and I know there's unanswered questions, and we need to answer them. None, you know, never mind these new areas that we want to look into. And so I'm scared about an outcome where 2 years from now we're sitting in the same meeting and we don't have significantly better answers about all these causes we're talking about, because the part of GiveWell we focused on was building our reach as opposed to finding
right.
better opportunities.
I would just say, I would still challenge you because I hear your passion, but passion, I mean, you got to spread the word. So if
right.
you believe that you have found, you know, if there's a $1 billion need and there's 100,000 people out there to give you 10,000 each, that's a huge reach. And so maybe it's, and I'm you more than my voice, I'm saying that I don't do the marketing thing, but I have seen it be very powerful. Well, and so I would say, you know, maybe you need to take that a little more, find somebody you like.
You support both your points actually simultaneously. With your skepticism, I ran a $2.5 billion company's marketing department, and your skepticism is totally well-founded. Your experience is completely typical. I've dealt with probably 15 agencies in the 20 years that I've done that work, and their mediocrity is characteristic of all of them and high price tags. But on the other hand, I also agree with you. But it has to be something that doesn't contaminate your organization. And I'd be more than happy to talk to you, not about myself. I don't think I'm great at marketing. I think I ran a great marketing organization, which is something I was good at, but I'm not a great marketing person. I know in San Francisco some great marketing people who would also be very sympathetic to GiveWell's mission. But I think it'd be really important to set up a nice firewall, in a sense, because of your pride, understandably, about not being a marketing organization. So it's a further discussion.
Right.
But I think both, I agree with you, and I agree with your skepticism. I can't tell you the number of hours I've wasted and the hundreds of millions of dollars on bad marketing.
Right. So to pull this back to the original question a little bit, there's there's an important distinction, I think, between spending money on something and spending staff capacity on it. And if marketing is money, so if you can bring in more money than you're spending, it's a no-brainer, if that's knowable. But we're generally skeptical that, you know, that it's that easy. What we do accept is that there is such a thing as someone who could be a fantastic marketer, who really got GiveWell, who could really help us. And from where we sit now, that takes staff capacity to find that person, to train them, to evaluate them. Our staff capacity is extremely tight. We have a lot of priorities. A lot of our priorities is building staff capacity, but that takes staff capacity. And so this is, you know, that is a much tougher decision, is how to use staff capacity. And the way that obviously it could all get resolved is if someone were to help us out and say, here's the person, they'll knock your socks off. Well, then, you know, that's a win all around. It just, that hasn't happened yet. And we're okay with it, to be honest. I mean, I think that we are doing well enough on the influence front to focus on our research for the time being. And there may be a time when we feel that our research is so great and hit diminishing returns and our organic growth has slowed and it's time to really focus on marketing. At that point, it'll be a much higher priority for staff capacity.
So I just wanted to, I think it's, we've been sitting here for a while, so I just wanted to take two more questions. But then everyone on GiveWell staff, we're going to stick around. So if people want to talk further afterwards, we're happy, but we don't want to hold you captive on Monday night too late.
No one's captive, though. Anyone can...
Everyone is captive. That wasn't clear. No one can leave at all until these two questions are complete. Well, yeah.
I actually have two questions. My first one is, what is GiveWell's room for further funding? And would you, I realize you probably couldn't recommend this as a number one charity on your website, but what would you like intuitively think that the impact of more funding for GiveWell's restricted funds?
Up 10% and down 10%.
Compared to your top three charities. And my second question is, there are marketing strategies that like are, you know, if you could hire, let's say you hire a firm that just specializes in Google AdWords, and they run a $10,000 test, and they show that they can bring in $12,000 in funding for your top three charities in with $10,000 of advertising, would you see that as an unethical use of funds? Like you're just reducing the like, efficiency
Okay, so these are, I'll try and roll these into one question. So these are both questions about kind of the impact of dollars given to GiveWell on GiveWell's impact and how good a deal that is and how good a deal it could be under certain circumstances. So, you know, to address our room for more funding, basically our official line to the public is that we don't have room for more funding and we aren't soliciting donations. The way that it actually works is that we have what we consider our inner circle, our core supporters, the people who really get what GiveWell is about and are passionate about it. And when we have a deficit, we go to them, we say we have a deficit, and we try to get that amount closed. And then we say we don't have a deficit anymore and we aren't soliciting funding. So we don't solicit funding from the public. A couple things on there. I mean, I think that the inside circle, it's we're generally not making the case to them that, like, if you don't give, we'll collapse. We're making more kind of a good citizen case. Like, you use this resource, help support us. The more that you help support us, the more solid ground we'll be on when we just go to other people and tell them to give to top charities. And so in a lot of ways, your gift to GiveWell is fungible with gifts to top charities. And it works in reverse, too. I think if you just give to top charities, that does directly help GiveWell. We've written about this. And so in a lot of ways, you know, those two things have a certain amount of fungibility. And so, you know, in many ways, one is similar to the other. What does happen when you give to GiveWell anyway, because some people do it, is that it, you know, is spent as we wish. We do have a process in place that says we can't have too many assets on hand relative to our projected expenses. We don't want to be piling up money like an endowment for ourselves without limit. So there are rules past which, you know, we would have to give some of that money to top charities. We generally, you know, in practice, that's not how we do things, because we generally stop aggressively raising money when we've got a balanced budget projected. So we don't hit this level of having like way too much assets and having to give it out. So that's how it works. If you give to GiveWell, it's somewhat fungible with gifts to top charities. It gives us a little more freedom. You may decide that's the best thing to do, but that's certainly not our pitch to the public or, you know, or generally to anyone. And then on the other question, I mean, would we spend $10,000 if we knew it was going to generate $12,000 in donations from AdWords? I think the quick answer is yes, because donations are sticky. And so those $12,000 are probably coming back at a very high rate in following years. So that's actually an extremely good rate of return. If we had kind of a, you know, oh, it's like a really close one dollar for dollar when you account for everything, I'm not sure. This hasn't come up. But we certainly, you know, there's a point at which we would say this just isn't efficient enough. We're doing more harm by kind of, you know, the redirecting of funds is not exactly as good as the just giving of funds, and so you have to weigh that in there somehow.
Just a quick concrete thing with AdWords is, you know, we've run AdWords for the whole time that GiveWell's been in existence. It's probably been the single most effective proactive marketing thing that we've done. Google has a program where they give nonprofits who are eligible free advertising with Google AdWords. We now get $40,000 a month worth of free Google advertising. We're actually not even reaching the limit, and we did retain an outside AdWords contractor to put together a campaign and help us manage it. So when we see things like that are obviously good returns, we spent a few thousand dollars at one point, and we have this AdWords campaign that's bringing a lot of donors to our site and has always been a pretty good return on investment, and now even more so.
Like, we basically do regard the Google grants as like free money, right? We're not running that calculation.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming. And